I'm Diane Rehm. Per Pedersen was not well known outside his native Norway until 2007, when he gained international fame for his novel Outstealing Horses. Pedersen's narratives have to do with the complex relationships between parents and children. His latest novel, I Curse the River of Time, is about a son's desperate attempt to get closer to his dying mother. The narrator of the story is Arvid, a character Pedersen has written about before. Per Pedersen joins me in the studio. We'll invite your comments, your questions throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I am honored.
Well, I am honored as well. The narrator of this book is desperately seeking a relationship with his mother, and yet at the very start of the novel, we learn that she is going to die. She has cancer, and she leaves.
Yes, she does. I indicate in the first chapter that she's Danish, and now she's been living in Norway for 40 years, married to this Norwegian man, worker. And when she learns that he has cancer, she wants to go home. And she's still, Denmark, this town that she's coming from, is still home for her. She always says home. And I just guessed that she wanted to do that, so I let her go home. And the son Arvid, of course, he goes after her to seek her out in a way. And I just thought that he had to. It's something you don't. I mean, I write on the intuition. I really didn't know. I thought this book is probably just going to be about her, the boy telling the story of his mother. And after one chapter, I realized that this was going to be about him and his relationship with the mother. So he's not telling only the story about her, he's telling the story about himself.
What's stunning in that first chapter is that she not only is leaving her son, she thinks, she's leaving her husband.
In a way she is. It seems like she's always kind of been alone in Norway, and the first thing she thinks about is not her husband. She just thinks about home, like the 40 years, in a way, didn't exist, perhaps. This is my thoughts, but I just wrote the book. It's very difficult for me to interpret the book. I look at it from the inside, whereas you look at it from the outside.
So you're saying, as you began the book, you thought it was going to be a son writing about his mother, and then somehow, as you went along, it developed that it was about a son seeking his mother.
And I didn't know that when I began the book, that it was going to be about that at all. Then I never know about my books, what they're going to be about. You have to find out. That's the, you know, that's why you read and I write it, you know. So, and I always work on intuition. So when, after the first chapter, I kind of figure out this is perhaps a little different than you thought. And I say, okay, let's do that. Because the other book that I might have planned, nobody's seen that book. I haven't seen that book. Who cares? So I write the book that comes. So always trust your intuition.
Arvid is 37 at the opening of the book. You were 37 when your mother, your father, your brother, and a nephew died.
That's true.
Tell us about that.
Oh, how can I? You know, like Arvid in the book, my family, we have this place, my mother's home in Denmark. We always went there in this, when I was a kid. We were there for 2 months each year, so I'm very familiar with the place. And this time it was Easter, and we were going to go there, my daughters and me, and my brother and my mother and my nephew. And this was on a Saturday. But then my wife's mother, whom I had divorced, she was going to have her 60th birthday. So my daughters were going to go there. So we were going to wait until Monday for me and my daughters to go, which was, well, I wouldn't call it lucky, but we would have died too. But we didn't. So there was this fire on the boat, and the security was like, well, not very good. So it all took fire, even though the air system just brought the fire everywhere in the boat. So, well, 159 people died.
Including
my family, yes. I just have the one brother, my elder brother, back, you know.
You've said that your writing changed after that fire. Can you describe from the inside out how it changed?
The most important thing with the change is, of course, that after that, the books I have written after that are books I couldn't have written when my mother was alive, for example. I couldn't have written the book called To Siberia when she was alive, because it's she would recognize it as being in part about her, and everybody else would think that it was about her, that her life. But, of course, I couldn't know what she was thinking, doing when she was 13 years old or something. So, but I couldn't, of course, not have written it when she was alive. And most of my books after that is a little like that. I have one called In the Wake, and which kind of starts with that fire, and I just leave it, and it tells about Arvid Jansen, the same man. When he, you know, the aftermath of that, his in the wake of that fire, and how he tries to, well, cope with his life, which is very difficult. He's under very hard pressure. And, well, it's a kind of bleak book that. It's also quite funny, because if you're under very hard pressure, you get a little slapstick-like. You know, the small muscles doesn't work that well anymore. So he becomes a little Chaplin-esque, if you could say it like that. And I think that's pretty funny.
Arvid's mother is not very happy with him.
No.
Why not?
Because life didn't turn out the way she hoped it would, which is very common, of course. I think she was thinking that this is a very intelligent woman, also, you know, she's kind of intellectual, though she never went to schools, really, and she reads a lot, and I think that she, you know, when you're pretty young and you read a lot and you have this kind of world inside your head, you think that this is the way you're going, that this room that you have, this space, is going to expand. And then she goes to Norway and gets pregnant. And this is like, you know, this is the late 40s, and abortion is not an option, and you marry the man. And so she did.
She married the man. This is the same man she is about to leave as soon as she finds out.
Yes, she says dying. That she feels sorry for him too. So she says, "I'm going to come back. Of course, I may need an operation, which I hopes would fix the troubles." But we don't know that, because the book stops before that. I don't really say she's dying. You know, it's not. It's a little open there. You know, my mother had cancer. She survived the cancer, but she didn't survive the fire.
The fact of the matter is, however, when Arvid's mother goes back to her home, she's going to meet another man, Hansen.
Hansen, yes.
Who is an old and dear friend.
He is, yes, that's true.
He understands her.
They have much more in common than she has with her husband, and they kind of, he's also a worker, you know, he's a railway worker, pensioned, I think they have a way of thinking about things. I wouldn't say intellectual, but they have a broader space, a thinking space around their lives that perhaps her husband doesn't have. This is also guessing, you know, because I haven't gone really into that, but I feel it's a little like that. Yeah, you know, some of this stuff in these books are autobiographical in a way, that the way that the persons could be the living persons that I had around me, but what happens isn't really what happened. It was could have happened. So Hansen is really based a little on a man we knew in Denmark, and my mother is a little like that. And sometimes when I talk about the books, I tend to talk about my own life, and I don't really know when I cross the line. And people say, is this in your book? It doesn't matter, I say. But it's not autobiographical in the sense that on what's happening on the page happened in real life. But it could have happened, maybe.
It could have happened that she had a better relationship with Hansen than she had
definitely.
With
I think
own
my
husband.
Mother had... She liked men in the way that she thought they were easier to talk to. They didn't... As she thought about it, they didn't talk so much rubbish. They were more to the point. And she liked that. She was a very... this man is very... well, he's where she is. And he doesn't talk rubbish.
But her husband didn't talk very much at all.
He didn't talk very much. It wasn't rubbish, perhaps, but it wasn't much. So I think she wanted to talk more about, you know, broader things. Yeah.
She lived in...
She's a very political person, too. She really, you know, she follows what's happening in the world. And I guess her husband doesn't talk much about that. So she needs that.
Per Pettersen. He's the author of 6 novels, including Out Stealing Horses, which received the International Impact Dublin Literary Award. His latest novel, I Curse the River of Time.
More Diane Rehm Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5 and 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. Good afternoon, I'm Elliot Francis. This afternoon at 3 on Bob Edwards Weekend, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas French spent 6 years in the zoo getting to know the cast of characters inside and outside of the cages. In his book, Zoo Story, Life in the Garden of Captives, French questions the morality of zoos through the stories that he tells of the animals and their keepers. That's on Bob Edwards Weekend this afternoon at 3. We're on WAMU 88.5.
Help keep WAMU 88.5 keep you informed, inspired, and entertained by making your donation through this year's Community First of Greater Washington, D.C. campaign. Thank you.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
In Per Pettersen's new novel, I Curse the River of Time, his central character, Arvid, looks nothing like his brothers. His brothers are all blonde-haired, fair-skinned. Arvid has dark hair. Everyone says how much he looks like his father. But Arvid doesn't want to look like his father.
No, he doesn't.
Would you read for us, Per Pettersen, from a portion of the book where he talks about his father?
I will. Okay. Wherever she went, my brother went too, the eldest, for he was the unwanted child, a child born in secrecy and shame off the coast of Denmark, among the marum grass and the grazing sheep on an island called Læsø. She had travelled there in haste with my brothers like a shimmering fish in her belly, and it bound them to each other with an ease which did not embrace me. He had sunshine and pain in his body inside the foamy blue and glittering room where he was so safe and so unwanted, like an outlaw. And the first thing he saw in his life was a sheepdog roaming the heath and gulls soaring above the port and the vault of blue sky above the island. The first thing I saw was my father's face and 3 grey, scrawny pigeons on the dusty windowsill behind the dangling blinds and the tram on Vålerengata. I was the only one of 4 sons who was planned, who was wanted by them both, and they told me this time after time, and each time as good news, as something to celebrate, and it gave me a legitimacy I could have done without. I longed to be an outlaw like my mother was and my brother, to be with them and share their pain, and in secret wander the dark streets at night in search of a place where I could belong. I would open the door to strangers and hide behind the mask like sorrow did, because it did not come easily to me what the two of them shared. It scared me. So as the years passed, I became the Lone Ranger, hunting for unsafe ground, and I clung to her, did tricks for her, performed for her, pulled laughter out of her with my silly jokes, whose punchlines were lost in linguistic confusion. As soon as I opened my mouth, the sentences came tumbling out at a shocking speed. I stayed in nappies longer than other children to tie myself to her. I could spell before I was out of nappies, but no matter how hard I tried, I was still like my father.
Was he like his father, not only in looks, but in his behavior?
He fears that, I think. He doesn't want to. I think his fears are a little unfounded. I think he's pretty much like his mother, really. But he's because he senses that his mother is that not that close to his father, he fears that he will be like his father because he looks like his father. And perhaps he thinks it works from the outside in or something, because the more he looks like his father, he fears will be like his father, which I don't think is true. I think he's very like his mother. Really, but the problem is, of course, that they don't recognize that in each other, I think, so they don't see it themselves.
She dismisses him greatly.
She does.
She gets very angry with him because he decides to drop out of university. He's squandering the money he has. He comes home. He says, I'm going to go to work. I'm dropping out of university. She slaps him. Across the face. You dropped out of university.
Well, I dropped out of everything. I always burnt my bridges, in a way. But it's true, at this time, this was in the 70s, I was very political, as Arvid was, and there was this movement, you know, get out of university, get out of college, go to work in a factory, because that's much more what we want to do. This is the future, to be there, and, you know, for some reason then, and do political work, which was not so important to do at the university, we felt, at the time. And I decided to do that and to go to work in a factory. And, you know, my mother, who always wanted to make something out of her life, to go further on, and suddenly her son, who's really had all the reason in the world to go on, and he's allowed to do that. And this was, in the history of Norway, this was really what was happening. All the working children, the workers' children could go to university. You could be whatever you liked if you sort of set your mind to it. And then I do the opposite of what she always wanted for herself. And this is, was like an insult to her, she felt.
How did she react?
Well, I wrote this book and I talked with my elder brother and he said, well, at least she didn't slap me. I said, and he said, very close to, you know, but you didn't know that.
Very close.
Very close to. She didn't have the opportunity, I think she would have slapped me.
She was very disappointed in
she
you.
She was very disappointed. She was very angry, and I didn't see her for some months. She just left the place where I lived. And like in the book, like after 2-3 months, she came at the door with Napoleon cakes, as they say. It's just a cream cake, but we call it Napoleon cakes in Norway. I don't think the French ever heard of it. And she did that. But the scene in the book is not what happened in reality. But she didn't make peace, though. She came because she was my mother. See, it's not like she forgave me or said that, well, I can see now that you can do what you want. She didn't say that at all, just because she's my mother. She has to have contact with me. So we came with this, not to make peace, just to eat cake.
And you sat and ate cake.
Definitely.
And
I like Napoleon cakes.
And she did not say anything further about your dropping out of university.
Didn't talk about it after that. Never mentioned it.
What about your other brothers?
Well, my eldest brother, he's an architect, And he, because he did what he should do.
He went to university.
He was there, and he went to England to go to school, did a lot of those things, which we were supposed to do. And my family had, you know, we had this street, working class street that we lived in, and my brother and I was the first to go to you know, what we call the gymnasium when you're 16 years to you're 19. We were the first kids on the block, as they say, who did that. And my mother was proud. And my brother knew that he was expected to go further, as we say in Norway, and he did. Never gave it a second thought. He was not as political as I was, so he just did it, which I think she was very happy about. Although she could snub him a little if he thought if he was like kind of haughty about it. Who do you think you are? She would say to him. So he pulled him up and knocked him a little down again.
What about your father?
He never talked about it. He was a very silent man. And when I quit college and went to work, and actually I went to work where he was. So we were at the same machine, this huge printing shop, you know, where they make newspapers. And we worked at the same machine for 4 years. And then I moved to another part of the factory. And he never said anything against it. I think he liked it. You know, because he had like 8 brothers and they all worked in the same shoe factory when he was young. And his father worked there. And I think he was a kind of a man, a collective man. He was a man who liked to have people around and to be one of the group. Whereas my mother was more of an anarchist, you see, like being alone. And when she rebelled, she did it for herself. I liked the collective things. And so I think he liked it that I was working with him.
Tell me where the title of the book, I Curse the River of Time, comes from.
It comes from a poem that Mao Zedong wrote. I took it from the Norwegian translation. If you go to an English translation of a poem, you won't find the lines because I took it from a Norwegian and I took it into English. But I remember that poem. I read it in the early 70s, and when I wrote the book, I hadn't seen it since. But, you know, if you trust your subconscious, it always comes to you what you want. When you're a writer, you have to trust your subconscious. So I just remember the poem because I was writing this chapter. I just went to, I found the book and opened it, and there was the title. Always happens.
But you know, here you were working as a machinist, same machine as your father,
yes.
Same area. Where and when did that writing urge begin?
See, being exposed to books. My father, who never read, he mostly, as I saw him, he read cowboy books, you know, and Nick Carter, spy novels, easy spy novels. When I was a kid, I saw him read those.
Spy novels, what are...
Spy novels, you know. Like,
oh, spy novels.
Yeah, like the Cold War and stuff, you know.
Yes.
But he had, in the 30s, he bought this bookcase, very beautiful, with carvings along the sides, and... In that bookcase, there was a lot of really classics, like Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Henrik Ibsen. Everything was in that bookcase, but he never touched the books. I never saw him touch the books. They were his books. And I asked my aunt once, and she said, oh, he always talked about Arthur and his books. But I never saw him read them. And my mother didn't read them, although she was a voracious reader. And but they were always there. It looked like just a piece of furniture with colors. And it was like when I was like 13 years old, I just took one book out by accident and opened it, and I could read it. I mean, it was obvious. I could understand what was in the sentences. So I just started to read, and I read them all. And I was exposed to books, which is important, I think. We talked about it yesterday with some friends, and he said, if you have more than 500 books in a home, your boy will read. Don't have to read for them again. I mean, he will read.
But you may read without writing.
Sure, yeah. At some point, not to everybody then, I guess, it says click.
When did it click for you?
When I was 18, I think.
Already working as...
No. I was going to gymnasium. It's before I dropped out of that, too. I always drop out. And I was, you know, the same week I was reading, you know, Hemingway's Nick Adams stories. And I read a book by the Swedish writer Per Lagerkvist. He had the Nobel Prize guest by Reality or something, the book was called in English. And another book by a Danish-Norwegian writer called Axel Sandemose. And all this comprised in 1 week, and something happened. I want to do that. I want to do what they do. I want to make people feel the way they make me feel. And after that thought, it was no return. I mean, I couldn't go back. So whatever I did after that was temporary. See, and I didn't want to go more to school. I tried, but I couldn't because I don't want to be an academic. I don't want to be anything like that. So I just burnt the bridges, and I did that for like 15 years. And I had nothing left. I worked in a factory. I worked there. I dropped out of another school because I thought if I'm going to be an architect or a teacher, I have to devote myself to that, of course. But I didn't want to. I wanted to be a writer, although I was not writing very much, in fact. Strange position to be in. So when I was 34, I finished my first story, although I wanted to be a writer for 17 years or something before that.
How were you supporting yourself?
Well, odd jobs.
Odd jobs.
And I started to work in a bookshop in Oslo, which was my university, you could say, because I was the one who imported books. Was my position. I got it at once, and I could import any book I liked as long as I sold it.
Per Pettersen, the book is titled I Cursed the River of Time. Do join us, 800-433-8850. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. That first work that you sold, to whom and how?
You mean in Norway publishing? It was, you know, I had written, I knew all these people. I knew my publisher who is sitting in the control room here. I knew him from before because this, well, he lived some of the places that I lived and I knew about him. And I published two short stories and his editor, not him, he read those and he called me and said, do you have more? And I said, of course I do, but I hadn't. So he said, well, if you have more, you know where to send them. Okay, I said. And so I ran home, and I had to write more. So I, just in desperation, I wrote two more stories, and I sent them to him and said, okay, if you have like six more, we have a book. Can you write six more? Sure, I said. And it all happens in a few months.
Really?
Whereas I didn't succeed writing anything, finish anything in the 17 years before.
So it just poured out.
Yeah, suddenly. It was like, you know, Turing. It clicked that time too. It was really strange. It's because I always wanted to write the big American novel, the big Norwegian novel, the working class novel, whatever. I tried to. I was very good at beginnings. Like the first 15 pages were brilliant, and then it died. And suddenly, it was Arvid Jansen that saved me because the two first books are about him too, in the third person. And suddenly I realized, hey, you have a project. And it's Arvid Jansen, well, at the time being it is. And it just opened up to me, and it was my own home that was my subject.
And, of course, we haven't talked very much about the fact that Arvid Jansen's wife wants nothing more to do with him.
That's true.
She leaves him. She asks him to leave her.
Mm-hmm.
And two girls.
Two girls.
Now
it's pretty sad that because it's. I think, well, obviously you see from the book that when they were very young, they loved each other really, and they had a very great time together. It was very tender in a way, and I wrote this chapter that actually let me have one chapter without pain. You see, and I try to do that in all the books I write, that what I call a pastoral. I want to have a pastoral here. I have to have one chapter where it's very quiet and very, you know, tender. So I wrote this about the two young people, and but the last sentence, I had to crush it, you know. So in the last sentence there, I crushed it.
What was that last sentence?
What was it? It was like, how strange that something so fine can be ground into dust and just disappear. And it's time that happens, because time is the crook here. So he curses the river of time that has done this to his marriage. But of course, he's done it himself. Time doesn't do anything.
Now, is that similar to your own marriage?
Not quite. I was divorced around the same time, but not that way. Not that way.
Two girls
I have, yes. And we did drive looking at fields, singing Beatles songs.
That was a wonderful scene in the book.
Yeah, I liked writing it, because yes. And I read it to my daughters, and they said, yeah, it's just like we did, didn't we?
Harmonizing Beatles songs. Yes.
They love Beatles.
Baird Pedersen, he is, of course, the author of the award-winning Out Stealing Horses, his latest, I Curse the River of Time.
More Diane Rehm Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5 and 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis. Here's good news for you. Now you can get text transcripts of the Diane Rehm Show. Simply visit WAMU.org, choose the program and the segment you're interested in, then click on the word transcript on the segment page, then view the text from the segment in as little as 6 hours after the original broadcast. WAMU 88.5 transcript service, courtesy of Aegis Rapid Text.
Every day, the Kojo Namdi Show explores important issues hitting home in your neighborhood, your region, and your world. It's your opportunity to speak out or just to listen, hear new voices, and share new views. Every day, noon till 2, on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM.
It is 82 degrees in Southeast Washington at 2:38.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, award-winning author Per Pedersen is with me. His newest novel, I Curse the River of Time. Of course, on our reader's review, we talked about the book Out Stealing Horses, which is why I so wanted to invite Per Pedersen in person to be on this program. Here's an email from Barbara, who's in Illinois, who says, as I listen to your guest discuss his mother and the mother in his book, I feel he's describing my own mother, who was born in Norway in 1917. The same strength and pride, same lack of formal education, immense intellect. She was the greatest influence in my life. Passed away in 2006. Her sisters and other members of her family are still in Norway and much the same. Do you think this is a typical description of a Norwegian woman?
Well, I don't know really, but where I grew up, in the house, in a roadhouse, like eight apartments in that house. And what I did notice was that the women were the strongest, I mean, in each flat, always. There was one strong man, but he was just strong by muscles. He beat up his family, but the woman sort of kept it all going. And when I was very little, you know, the mothers visited each other because they had to stay at home. They had like 4 or 5 kids. And it was much more interesting to listen to them talk to each other than the men always sort of bragging and trying to show who was the strongest and stuff like that. And which was interesting for a boy, of course. But it was very interesting to listen to the mothers talk. And they were strong, yes. I think she is in a way typical. Not every woman where I grew up was kind of an intellectual, you know, a type. My mother was the one who read books. I don't think so many others read so immensely as she did. But they kind of liked it that she did.
Is Arvid an alcoholic?
No, I don't think so. Everybody
he drinks a lot.
He gets drunk.
He's 37 years old. He gets drunk a lot.
Wow.
Don't you think?
I don't think, I'm not quite sure. I mean,
To get drunk at his mother's birthday party, so drunk that he is not able to give her a toast.
Well, you know, when you write a book, it's, you realize if it's a tragedy or a comedy. And I just saw this film when it described the difference between a tragedy and something tragic. Tragic things happen accidentally, whereas a tragedy, it has to go wrong. Like in Shakespeare, it has to end with death. It has to end, not on the upbeat, but on the downbeat. And I kind of realized that when I write the book. He cannot give that speech. So how can I write this chapter without him giving the speech, and at the same time expect himself to do it and the others expect him to do it? So I just had to wait that chapter out. I was not quite sure what to write. Will he give the speech? Well, what will he say? I was very nervous about that. So I just didn't write it until it came to me naturally that this was the way it's going to be. And this, you know, this speech, you're going to talk about the Rio Grande, this river that is sort of as an image of how he was separated from his mother. And the Rio Grande was, the big news was that he had dried up. So there was no water there. So they could, you know, they could walk across and meet each other in the middle of that river, which was just rubbish, of course. But he forgets. The speech is in his jacket. The jacket is in where
he forgets.
Yeah, he gets the speech. And he doesn't remember, because he's drunk, what it was about the Rio Grande that was so important. So what he says to his mother when he's drunk, "I don't remember anything about you." And she says, "That's just as well."
Oof.
Yeah, it was a little embarrassing, that. And it was painful. But I heard that, you know, the Nobel Prize winning Coetzee, the writer, he said something that I heard very recently, and he says, when you write books, always move towards pain. And I was very relieved to hear that, because that's what I've always been doing, intuitively, because that's what the interesting stuff is. Comedy you can watch on film. I don't want to read comical books. Tragedies.
Let's take a caller in Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Van. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is very serendipitous, because I was going on vacation this summer and I'd never heard of your author. And I was in the library and I looked in the book club's favorites and I picked it out and I really enjoyed it. And so then I'm listening to the radio today and I'm hearing the author, and then I'm hearing who it is. And I just finished the book, Out Stealing Horses, and my question is, I was confused by the ending, and I was just wondering what you were thinking when you wrote the ending and why you wrote it the way you did.
Well, the ending is in this Swedish town, Karlstad, where they're going to pick up the money that the father of the boy has earned on this logging business. And it turns out that the money is not much, because most of the logs have been sort of drowned in the river and never got there. And so it's much less money than they thought. And the mother decides she's going to buy a suit for the boy, which is just about what the money is. And she does. And it looks like the mother is almost falling in love with her boy, because he looks suddenly so grown up. And for a moment there, she has her 15 minutes in the book. She's not very important in the book, but then suddenly she gets, you know, at the end there, she's important for a while, and then she sort of recedes back into anonymity after that. It's just when I wrote that scene, it just stopped. This is where it stops. Let it hang, in a way. I had nothing to say after that. That's why it ended there.
Okay, I see.
I don't think that's a good answer, really.
No, that's fine. I expected it to flash back to the boy when he's older, living house, you know, and so I was expecting something, but I guess, you know, I just finished it yesterday, so I have to think about it some more. I was expecting something different.
No,
I don't know what I was expecting, to be honest with you, but it surprised me, because it kind of like it ended in the past with this memory, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So anyway,
It begins with the ending, you know.
It begins with the ending, indeed. Van, thanks for calling. There are some similarities in the dialogue you use in this latest book, I Curse the River of Time, from similarities to what your mother said to you before she died on that boat. You gave her, she read your first novel.
She did.
And what did she say to you after she read it?
Well, really, I had, this was my second book. I had short stories first and then this small novel, and both of them were more or less about my family in a fictional way. And my father never mentioned the books, the two books, and my mother never mentioned the two books. They didn't speak about it, so I didn't really knew if they had read them at all.
You had, of course, sent them to them, had you not?
Sure, yeah, sure. But they never said anything, and I didn't know if they liked it or they were embarrassed by it or whatever. And then she rang. I was freshly divorced, not very happy, and she called me and said something about, she had kind of a reason to call me, and we talked about that. And then she said, well, let's hope the next book won't be so childish, she said. And I was, hey, what's this? And she just, you know, hung up.
That was it.
That was it. That was the last thing she said to me. And like 2 weeks after, she was dead. So I never spoke to her again. And was so, everything was sort of hanging in the air. And it was...
So you did not have the opportunity to ask her, well, what do you mean childish? Why do you think it was childish? Or... perhaps you were reluctant or even afraid to ask.
You could say that, but...
I did.
Yeah, but I didn't get the opportunity. I had to swallow that one first, but the next one didn't come because she was dead. And it always bothered me, that.
I understand.
Not just about the book, because it was kind of negative. The last thing we said to each other was... I was a little irritated by it, that she said that, and also hurt, because I thought the books were good, very good reviews, but she was kind of expecting something else from me, something bigger, something more ambitious, I think, which I may have done now, but she would never have read that.
And then Arvid's wife says something to him in the book.
Yes, he's been on this drive with his daughters. He knows that he's going to be divorced, although they hadn't sort of agreed on when. And they come home to the flat after the driving. His wife is there, and he feels very bad. And then she's at the bathroom coming out, and he closes his eyes. He doesn't want to look at her. And she said, hey, stop that. It's so childish, she says. But he doesn't want to open his eyes because he knows how she looks. She looks like the girl who doesn't want him anymore. So, and that is childish. That's what a child do when they don't want to face the things in front of them. They close their eyes. And because they are children, we understand them. But this man is 37 years old, so we can understand him. But it is true. It is a childish reaction.
Why has Arvid had such a hard time growing up?
I really don't know. It's one of the chapters is when he's very little, from where the family lived in the working class district inside Oslo. And I really thought about it myself. I have to write myself back to there, I thought, you know, just see if is there something there to find that would explain this to me, because I just wrote it, you know. I didn't think really much about it, why. And I wrote that chapter because to try to find it out, and it really didn't. The part that I read is part of that chapter. What I found is what it was already there, in a way, this distance between them. Although she was early also diagnosed with cancer, and it may be that if you are really ill and you have small children and you have to do something about your illness, there will be a distance between you and the outside world. It includes your children, maybe. And maybe this is where this sort of gap between them starts. It may be like that. But I don't have the answer, really. I don't know if I found that out.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Of course, finding out is such an extraordinary thing for an author to say about his own character, that he doesn't quite understand why this most wanted child was so childish as an adult.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there's a direct link between the two, but it's really... what you do when you write books like I do, you don't know things. I don't plan or plot or anything.
You don't do any of that.
Nothing.
You just begin to write.
I don't even like to do, you know, research. I hate research because it destroys the flow. Check afterwards, I say. I don't know this Arvid when I start to write the book. That's the reason I write the book, because to find out what this is, and things come. And if I get, you know, distracted, I can't go back until I find the mood that I was in when I stopped. So I just can't go on with my plot. So.
What about rewriting?
I don't do that. I write a chapter and then I work on the chapter. When it's finished, it's finished. And then when the book is finished, the book is finished. I don't do full drafts. How could I? Because I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm very tired when I'm finished the books, because... I had this hard time finding out what it is about and writing it as well as I can, which I think is a good thing. I think you're more sharp when you try to find out things, because you have to be very precise. If you have a plot, you can always follow the plot, and the sentences can be good, not so good, doesn't so much matter. But if you write like I have, you have to have good sentences sort of to pin down what this is.
Will we learn more about Arvid?
Maybe. He will be in another book, I'm
sure.
Is
he already in your mind? Have you begun another book?
I've begun another book, but not about Arvid Jansson. I can't write about him now.
You can't.
I have to wait.
Why?
I don't know how he is, what he's like now.
We don't know whether his mother dies.
You don't really know. If Arvid Jansson is... the same Arvid Jansson as in the book In the Wake, his mother does die in that fire, like my mother did. But here, maybe she dies when... I chose the year 1989 for this novel because it was the year before my mother died. So it just gave me some place in time. And I didn't realize when I started to write the book that 1989 was, of course, a big year in European history and also in China. You know, with what happened on the Tiananmen Square, where they shot the students there who was rebelling. And the wall fell.
The wall?
The wall.
Of
and
course.
The Soviet Union sort of started to disintegrate. And my mother was very, you know, she was really following that. And I did, of course, and we all did. But I didn't choose the year because of that. Not for political reasons, just because it was the day before my mother, the year before my mother died. So... but your intuition works for you. Your subconscious chooses things.
If you're a writer.
And if you trust it.
Per Pettersen, his latest novel, I Curse the River of Time. Congratulations.
Thank you so
much. It's a beautiful novel. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Japan asking, what do we need to know to play baseball here?
You suppress your own ego on behalf of the team.
Even if I'm better than them?
You're out!
Don't be too aggressive. Don't throw balls too close to the batter. If you throw too close, you had better take off your cap and bow low.
This is John Malott,
president of the Japan America Society.
And he's not describing the baseball game I played in my younger years. He's describing the Japanese version, where it's about how you play the game as much as winning.
You would never criticize the manager. You would never disagree with the manager. You would never say anything critical about your teammates in Japan.
There was even a time, Malott says, when a pitcher wouldn't try too hard to strike out the hero of the opposing team. There are other differences, too.
If it's tied at the end of the ninth, they will only go for three more innings. If they get to the 12th inning, they just stop the game right there. And you get a half a win and a half a loss.
Malott says each player has his own cheer.
So when he's at bat, they chant a cheer that is associated just with that player. And they bring in musical instruments and trumpets and drums and big flags. And they cheer as a group.
Baseball first came to Japan through an American teacher in the 19th century. During World War II, many of the American words they'd adapted for Japanese baseball were replaced with Japanese names. But the American versions came back.
Homu run or strike or baru auto. When you get four balls, they don't call it a walk. They call it four baru.
Even the team names have borrowed from America.
Dragons, dragons, or the taigazu, the tigers. You have the Fukuoka Hawks. You have the Oryx Buffaloes.
Malott says his organization keeps a list for visitors from Japan on what not to bring to an American baseball game. This list includes
taiko drums or cymbals or trombones, massive flags. They think that an American baseball game is a lot more staid.
Despite the differences, Malott says the appeal of baseball to the Japanese is obvious.
You might even say sort of the zen of baseball. Baseball is a quiet game. Even when you come to an American baseball park, there are these moments of silence. Until someone hits the ball, it's very, very quiet.
Malott also has some last-minute advice for Americans wishing to visit a Japanese baseball game.